Hello. Today you'll be hearing a series of recordings made from different individuals who all dealt with situations and experiences that crossed boundaries. Our first podcast is from the radio show called The Adam Show. In this interview, radio host Adam gives two very special guests to talk about their experiences with stereotypes and racism. Enjoy.
Good morning, America. My name is Adam. Welcome to The Adam Show. And today we have two special guests. One special guest will be speaking, pretty soon. Her name is Yana. Yana, say hi to the world.
Hello.
Hi. Yana, you want to tell the world, what is your profession and what do you do?
I am a registered nurse at CHOP, and I take care of wonderful children.
Okay.
And people, and I enjoy my job very much.
Okay, so what are some of your hobbies?
I like reading, writing, talking,
okay,
going to school, working.
Pretty basic, okay.
Yeah, the basic things, shopping here and there. Nothing major.
That's good.
Our second guest refused to release any information about herself, but she does say that it's okay to state that her name is Letitia. I began to ask the question on how did it feel to be called a racial slur? This is what Letitia had to say.
I mean, I probably so, because they'd be like, they'd be like, oh, you came across the border, but they were just like, okay. I never took it to offense. It's like, it was a joke and everything, but I mean, it happens on an everyday basis. Everybody makes fun of each other.
I've been called a mutt. A mutt is a dog. Pretty much, you just have to be a mixed child, pretty much. It doesn't matter whether you're, majority of the time it's just if you're Caucasian and African American. But I guess people just started using the word as if it was okay to use the word. I mean, I don't mind
because
it sometimes.
The word mulatto.
Right. Mulatto comes from mutt, pretty much.
Yeah.
Mulatto
means a mixed child.
Yeah, because a mutt is a mixture of two dogs. I can't remember what dog, but it's a mixture of two dogs.
So it's short way from mulatto to mutt.
That's what they used to call people back in the day.
Yana begins to point out that it's not only friends who pull racial cards. It can be family members as well. She had an experience with a grandmother. Here's what she has to say.
I know my grandmother, she used to make fun of me because she was fully Dominican. She was fully Dominican, and, my brothers and sisters, they were mixed as well, but, my little brother, he wasn't able to understand it. My other little brother, he's fully, and my sister, she's fully, so it was just, to me, I felt like I was the only one picked on, and she used to say little things like, she would call me a mutt, she would call me whitey, or certain things like that. I was a light kid, but at the same time, I felt like becoming from my family member, why are you saying anything? I could call her any type of name I want. Like, I could call her, we're not even going to talk about that, but it's okay. I could call her so many things, but I choose not to. There's a lot of typical things that people say about Dominicans. They say that they look black, but to me, I don't feel like, your hair doesn't have to be a certain way, your body don't have to be a certain way, your complexion don't have to be a certain way to be a certain race. To me, it doesn't make sense. Like, my uncle's best friend, he's black, blacker than black, black like the street, black like this table. But everyone thought he spoke English. Everyone thought he was black. No, he was Mexican. And I mean, I saw it because, obviously,
but again,
I know.
That's a Mexican. But again, that's a stereotype because you just said, this don't define none. But how did you know he was Mexican?
I knew because, obviously my uncle told me, but I knew, he told me, and the guy and I used to have conversations. So it was just like, I knew, and he would tell me, the history in his family, his mother being Mexican, his dad being Mexican. So it was just like, where he came from, that's why he is the color that he is. And he said that he used to get made fun of a lot because his hair wasn't a certain way. And, he didn't act a certain way. And it's mainly with girls, though. Mainly with girls. Like, there are some girls out here. It bothers me.
Because
me being 23 years old, it bothers me when some girls say, oh, well, you know, I got that good hair and this, that, and other. There is no such thing as good hair. That's my opinion. There's no such thing. To me, good hair is...
It's such thing as good hair because, I don't know, this might sound rude, but there's some girls out here has, like, hair like Brillo pad. And
it's okay. I'm saying, like, there's no such thing as having, like, good hair. Like, oh, you have to be this color and this race to have that texture of You're hair right. or that length of hair. No, there are some Hispanics or some African-American... No, why did I say African-Americans? Caucasians who have short hair, who were born with short hair. Just because you have long hair and it's maybe a certain texture doesn't mean that you're mixed. It doesn't. It does not at all. My mom's co-worker's daughter has some long-ass hair. It comes right here. She's fully African-American. Fully African-American. If you take care of your hair...
You don't think it's weave?
If you take care of your hair, then it'll be the way you want it to be. Some people just don't take care of their hair. Or they're not born with a certain texture of hair. So it doesn't have anything to do with race. Most of the time.
But most people think, like, oh, if their girl is, like, if she's African-American, they were like, oh, that's not her red hair. That's weird.
Right. Because they make a stereotype.
Because, like, oh, that's not her red hair. It got to be weird. Because there's no such thing she would right. ever have a hair that comes right. off her head.
Right. It's a stereotype. Basically, you have to be a certain race to have this length of hair and this texture of hair.
It's the same thing. But it's the same thing even with clothing-wise. Like, it's a stereotype between race and how they dress. Like, for example, like, Hispanic used to always get picked on, like, of the shoes they used to wear. Like, you know how a lot of Hispanics used to always wear Jordans. And then, like, the African-Americans would be like, oh, only Hispanic people wear them. How can you wear Jordans? Or they get messed up. But now it's in 2013. Now they're wearing Jordans. Like, now it's just like, you just did a stereotype, but now you put them on your feet.
I feel like people only base their stereotype because they see it a lot on that person. And majority of the time, people were just like, oh, okay, well, I know this little girl that lives next door to me, she gets mad when her hair doesn't turn out a certain way. And I told her one day, I said, you better be happy you got head on your damn head. Because half these motherfuckers out here are bald head. You better be happy you got something on your head. But you don't have to be mixed, white, black, Puerto Rican, Dominican. And you don't have to be any of that to have a nice texture of hair and a nice length of hair. It just doesn't. To me, it frustrates me a lot. It bothers me. Like, I don't like hearing people have conversations about that. Oh, yeah, my hair is long because, you know, I'm Indian, I'm white. No, bitch, let me see your damn birth certificate. Seriously. Let me see it. No.
During the interview, Letitia brings up a story about her friend who used to hang out with a lot of boys and how it pretty much affected her, and how rumors began.
Yeah, like, there was this time when, like, this girl in my school, like, she only hanged out with a bunch of boys, and they used to call her a whore, like, oh, she slept with the whole team, because she's always hanging out with them. But, as I got to know her, it was just a person, she just hanged out with a lot of boys. She don't get along with a lot of girls, because she said hanging out with girls can get you more trouble, because they always gossip and everything. So she always hang out with the basketball team. And, like, people in my grade, she's like, oh, she's a whore, because she always playing with them. Or she doing certain things, or is going hanging out with them. And then, out of nowhere, rumors started to come out, oh, she's sleeping with them. But that was never a fact. And I used to hang out with her, and she would just be like, I hang out with a lot of boys, but that don't make me a whore. It just, like, I choose to hang out with guys, because guys need a drama. It's like, girls always start drama. They see somebody walking on the street, oh, well, I don't like her, or she's a whore, or this type of person. And when she used to hang out with the boys, it was just like, I never took it as a whore. I just thought, oh, she's just uncomfortable in her skin hanging out with boys than she is with girls. And when I'm like, that's crushing, like, I'm like, that's crushing the boundary. You calling her a whore. You don't even know the girl. Like, you don't know her. But then it's like, they kind of, like, contradict themselves, because they started doing the same thing she was doing. They started, like, going, they started hanging out with, like, the boys that she used to hang out with. And then everybody started calling them a whore. It was like, it keeps going. Like,
was she really a whore, though?
No, she wasn't. She was just, she just like hanging out with them. She used to go play basketball with them. She would just always hang out with them. I used to consider her a whore because she hang out with the boys. And the boys, like, they know how to get, like, flirtatious and everything. and they was consider her a whore because she hang out with them. But the girl that used to call her that started hanging out with them too. And then it became, oh, they are a whore now because now they hang out with her.
In this second podcast, you'll hear about a young lady named Jessica Ruggiero, whom is a high school academic director at Squash Marts. The interview asks her about her major events in her life and how her life would be different if those events did not occur.
What's your full name?
Jessica Lee Ruggiero. I am the oldest out of four siblings. I have three younger sisters. I am originally from northeastern Pennsylvania, so the Poconos, but both my parents grew up in New York and the Bronx. My mom currently lives in the Poconos. My dad and two of my sisters live in Oregon, so I get to go out there a few times a year, and that's a lot of fun. And then I have a sister who's in the Air Force, so she lives in Texas, so I also try and get out there as much as I can. It's kind of hard to travel to both places.
She spoke about language and religion.
I was raised Catholic. The more I've learned about different religions, I realize while they are all very different, I find that there's a lot of common aspects, which are kind of cool too. So who's to say whose religion is right or wrong? In my senior year of college, I had to read Mayan sacred text called the Popol Vuh. My favorite story was called Babel, and it was like about like people who wanted to reach their gods, and they had multiple gods, and they wanted to communicate with them, and everybody spoke the same language. They started building a tower so that they could go up and talk to their gods because they had questions for them. The gods got really angry that they were building this tower to go up to them, and they were like getting like, I guess, close. So the gods like knocked down the tower and spread them all over the world and made it all so that they all speak different languages. And I thought that was the coolest story because it like gave an explanation of like why people speak different languages in different countries so that they could never communicate with each other again and build that tower. It's one of my favorite stories. I found that a lot of the stories in the Popol Vuh reminded me of a lot of stories in the Bible. And now that I'm reading a few Hindi sacred texts, I see like a lot of similarities. Also, I think it's really cool that no matter how different they are, there's always like these common aspects.
She described what she does.
Right now, I am a high school academic director at an after-school program called Squash March. Squash March is an after-school program where we teach the sport of squash as well as have an academic component. So kids usually start in the 6th, 7th grade, depending. They try out and they wind up, you know, hopefully sticking through the program until 12th grade when they graduate. So my job once they get into high school is really to help them prepare for college. I like to do a lot of SAT prep. Fun part is the college visit and going through the whole college process and the application process and the financial aid and then watching everyone get accepted.
She explained why she comes back to work every day.
You guys, yeah, the student, as fun as Squash March is, it isn't always fun. Different things in the office aren't always that fun, but it's you guys and the practices and it's always a different day. Like, I am never bored of work. Bad day or good day, it is always interesting and always different, and that's what makes me want to come back, because I definitely am not the type of person that wants a desk job, and I definitely like the spontaneity of Squash March and the trips that we take and just definitely the practices and being around the students.
She explained what she does outside of Squash March.
Outside of Squash March, I am currently actually taking a teacher training for yoga, so I plan on becoming a yoga instructor on the side as kind of a release and something different to do. So if I'm not at Squash March, I'm generally at the yoga studio.
Has she completely decided what to do in her life?
I've decided what I want to do right now, but I don't know. I feel like, you know, life's always changing and evolving, and you never know where it'll take you, and so I think it's nice to be open-minded and just kind of go with the flow. But I decided my senior year in Widener University down in Chester that I wanted to do something in education. So it wasn't until my last semester of college that I decided where I really wanted to go and take it, because before I was just doing something really more broad and just learning like Spanish. I was learning Spanish at the time. But then, you know, came across Squash March and really found that it was a better fit for me.
When asked who she looks up to in life as a mentor, she said,
Kind of a difficult question. But I would say both my grandfathers. Both my grandfathers played a pretty important role in my life. My parents had me when they were pretty young, so my grandparents were around a lot. And I feel like my one grandfather in particular, he was kind of always around and always pushing me to do better. And, you know, if I was getting in trouble in school, he was always kind of pushing me and, like, just guiding me towards the right direction. So I feel like he was really my support system. And especially going into college, when there were things that I didn't think I could do, he was kind of there to always, you know, just talk it through with me and be like, no, you can do it. So he's definitely a big reason of where I am today, because I didn't always think that college was an option. You know, I was always, I don't know, I can't say I was always 100% sure. I would be a completely different person had I not had the grandparents that I do.
She spoke about her behavior as a teen.
I would say that I had a little bit of a rebellious stage in my life. Yeah, I mean, I did well in school. It wasn't really necessarily with my grades, but I was like, you know, maybe getting in arguments with people a lot, or I was really talkative and or didn't really want to listen, and, or wanted to sneak out and hang out with my friends late at night and didn't understand why I had to have a curfew kind of thing. So he was kind of always there to be like, Jess, is it really worth getting in trouble with your parents over something so silly kind of thing? Probably say my freshman year was my toughest year, so maybe I wasn't doing that great in school. And that's when it's like, you know, where do you want to see yourself? Like, in these, this, what you're doing right now and the grades you're getting isn't really going to get you where you want to be or get into college. So definitely sophomore year, I turned it around and really started concentrating on schools.
And I don't know why I did them. Yeah, I was in the teen mindset. I was definitely a typical rebellious teenager. I don't regret anything. That thing makes you who you are. I firmly believe that. And I think it's nice because now I have the experience to, when I, especially since I do work with high schoolers now, to be like, I've been through it and it's not worth it. And it's something that you kind of have to figure out on your own and then realize like, okay, this is not the path I want to go down because life's just going to be really difficult that way.
She spoke about major events in her life.
The first major event in my life was my parents getting divorced. So I would say that was definitely a major event in my life. Being the oldest out of four kids, I was definitely had to be like a role model for my sisters and kind of the support system that made me, I feel like, become who I am and become more independent and more focused on what I wanted in life because of that.
I really had mixed emotion about the whole thing. I remember my parents used to fight a lot. And I remember telling my mom one day that I just wished her and my dad would get a divorce and they would stop fighting and I wouldn't have to hear it anymore. Life could be better. And when they did get a divorce, it unfortunately wasn't like a very nice divorce. So it was really difficult.
And segueing into that, that happened my junior or senior year of high school. I would say another major important major event in my life that was life-changing for me was getting into college. So I was the first in my family to go to college, which was really exciting and really nerve-wracking. I decided to go away for college, so I went 3 hours away from home. I definitely wanted to just experience a new place and get outside where I grew up, with a very small town. So there wasn't much that I, you know, besides New York, there wasn't a lot that I knew, so I wanted to see what else was out there. So I came down to Philadelphia, went to college, and because I was paying for college on my own, I think that college was really the first time where I really took things super seriously. And, you know, I took extra classes when I could. I made sure I got best grades that I could. I mean, I did really well in college. And I think it was because my focus and my determination and, you know, the fact that I was doing it on my own, it was something I was really proud of. And it was definitely, you know, you in college, you get a chance to really grow up. It was a really cool part of life. After that, or kind of during that, I studied abroad. I decided once I was in college, through the advice of my advisor, that I should learn a second language because originally I was studying international business. One of my professors was from Spain, and she had suggested that I go to this smaller region of Spain called Leo, which is in the northwestern part of Spain, a smaller city, so it wasn't super commercialized. So I was really able to learn the language, immerse myself in the culture. Nobody else from my school went there, so I didn't know any other English-speaking people at first. And then when I did, I kind of distanced myself from them, and I only, you know, I met people while I was in Spain, and I made sure I only hung out with them. And that really made me become bilingual, you know, so then I had to pay my rent in Spanish, and I had to, you know, do all these things in Spanish because I had to. I remember, like, when I first got there, I remember thinking, my gosh, I've been taking Spanish classes for how many years, and I don't understand anybody at all. I was like, what have I been doing for these past years? And then by the end of the 6 months, I was like, wow, I really, like, I speak Spanish. This is really cool. That was a huge part of my life. I'm now bilingual. It was the best 6 months ever. So if college was great, then studying abroad was even more awesome. I recommend it to everyone. Last but not least, another major event in my life that I would think life-changing was marrying my husband, Tim. We just got married in June. We met in college. But him and I are like best friends. We were friends before we started dating and dated for a few years before we got married. But, you know, we may not necessarily know everything we want to do and have life totally figured out. But, you know, whatever we plan on doing, we know we want to do it. We're doing it together. And we're both really open-minded about that, about traveling and stuff. So I think that's really cool.
How would your life be different if these major events did not happen?
I think that I would be a more closed-minded person. So I think going away for school, even though it was only 3 hours away, studying abroad, and, you know, I did some traveling elsewhere. I've always liked different cultures and different languages, but it really made me aware of almost how closed-minded I feel like sometimes Americans in general can be, or, you know, the stigma that...
The stereotype,
you know, and I think it is a little true, but I think that it just made me so much more open-minded, and I think that now that I've learned about one culture and one language, I'm, like, so curious about every other culture and language, and I think world is my oyster, and I'm just, like, ready to go see and learn as much as
I can about everything. Yeah, my life would be a lot more boring.
Have you ever faced a situation that was hard to overcome emotionally?
Definitely. I think people have to face a lot of situations that are difficult to overcome throughout life. But the one I think that comes to mind would be my sister's moving after college.
If there was one thing you could change about your life, what would it be?
I'm generally hesitant to say something I'd like to change, but if I had to choose one thing, I think it would be that I would have been more involved in both high school and college, I would say.
When asked about one quote she would give others as advice, she said,
"A quote that I would tell people is that where your focus goes, energy flows." It's been kind of my mantra. I feel like sometimes, and just through different things that I've experienced, the more you focus on negative things that are going on in your life, the more negative things happen, and that's where your energy goes. So that's all you're focusing on, that you can't really focus on the positive parts of your life. So,
okay. Thank you.
The next podcast is about a mother's journey on becoming an educator. The interview tells the story of her struggles and her experiences.
In this project, I chose to interview my mother, who has gone through her own ups and downs in her search for a job that makes her happy and fulfills her. I admire my mother's hard work and determination, which is the reason why I chose her for this project.
I am an assistant professor of sport marketing at St. Joe's University. This is my second semester. I started in August of 2012. I was a tax attorney for the city of Philadelphia, and I love the change in job.
My mother was a strong student at Girls High, and when she graduated and went on to Drexel, she wanted to be an engineer, which she quickly learned was not the right decision for her
to be. And I chose to go to Drexel because of their cooperative education program. But I didn't go there to study education. I started in engineering.
Which is completely different from teaching.
Yeah. But, you know, after three trimesters in engineering, I knew that that wasn't how my mind worked. And then made the switch to business. And that was a much better fit for me. And so I had a business degree with a concentration in finance and ended up in banking out of college. I didn't want another business degree. I wanted a law degree because that would give me a different skill set, and a skill set that if I wanted to, I could be entrepreneurial, have my own business.
After working at various banks and the Chief Justice of Pennsylvania, my mother decided to attend law school at Temple, where she had a very unconventional experience, being a little bit older than the traditional law school student and being in a night class and having a full-time job. Her last year was especially unconventional.
And I knew I'd be moving and leaving a job. This was a good time to try and start a family. And so that's what we did. And so I was pregnant my last year. So that was fun toward the end. Challenging toward the end. You were born 1 month after my graduation. So trying to take exams with my 9-month pregnant belly and you kicking because you had no room was challenging, but, you know, we got through it.
Made it work.
Yeah.
That's why I have brains.
I guess.
After moving to Massachusetts, my mother decided it was a good idea for her to stay at home.
Made the transition up to Massachusetts, where I chose to stay home with you.
After staying home with me for 2 years, my mother put me in daycare and began pursuing a master's degree in sport management at the University of Massachusetts. A year after working towards her master's, the University of Massachusetts asked my mother to stay on full-time to teach in 2000.
And Head and I are still friends to this day, and we chuckle that in 1 year I'm not the ideal candidate, and then the next year I have keys to every room in the office, and you continue to go after what you want. And I'm patient, and
clearly you deal with me all day.
And I keep at it. In 2003, I started teaching part-time at the Wharton School. You know, the teaching wasn't happening, so I said, I need to pass the bar so I can at least have a license. But I'm 10 years out of law school.
With no tenure job in sight, my mother began to prepare for the bar, which she decided to take 10 years out of law school.
I get up in the morning, I dropped you at camp, I hit my gym for an hour, hour and a half, come home, study. Eat well, and be in bed.
My mother worked at a private law firm and worked at Wharton for one more year before transferring.
And so that was challenging because prepping class takes quite a bit of work. Grading takes quite a bit of work. So it was a lot of late nights. There were nights when the nights before I would teach, I was usually up to 3 and 4, sometimes 4 o'clock in the morning. And then still had to get up, get you to school by 8 o'clock, and then head into the office. I moved from the small litigation firm to the city because I wanted to manage my own caseload. And there I knew I could either sink or swim with a government agency. Because there's not a lot of training. They hand you your files. These are your cases. Good luck. You know, very quickly, I could see that the work was not going to be satisfying for me.
3 years into working for the city of Philadelphia, my mother received an opportunity to begin teaching at St. Joseph's University, which she did not end up getting the job the first time she interviewed. The job instead went to the first female president of an MBA franchise.
So I went back to practicing and, you know, was really, really not liking it. And so I've been doing that for almost 2 months. And I get a call from the chair of the department asking me if we could resume our talks because the woman they hired was going to finish out the spring semester, but she wasn't coming back in the fall.
My mother interviewed for St. Joe's a second time around and got the job, which was life-changing not only for her, but for me to witness. To watch my mother become such a happier person was something I'll never take for granted and I'll never forget.
Dean had the final say, and I was on vacation with you in New Mexico, sitting in the car outside of Whole Foods when the dean made me the offer. And I happily accepted with the calmest, coolest voice.
Even though your face was saying much otherwise.
Yeah, even though I was about ready to jump out of my skin.
Life is different for my mother and I now. We have so many changes to our daily routine, but I think we make it work.
I go in early. So I teach at 9. I usually get to work at 7:30. So I can have coffee and take a look at my notes, print out any handouts. And then
you get your busy work done, basically.
No, I just kind of try and ease into the day. I usually like to, you know, look at my notes, make sure that I'm clear on my learning objectives for that class, and that I deliver it in a way that they know why they're there. And so, you know, you prepping, and then it just is an opportunity to sit back and say, okay, this is how today's class is going to flow. Then I teach. If I have office hours, I'll see students for office hours. I have administrative meetings to go to, so I sit on some university committees, and those are usually on the days I don't teach. I also meet with other professors that I'm working on research with so we can talk about our papers and our approaches and where we are and what our deadlines are. I'm helping with the marketing and promotion of a sport marketing conference that we're doing. That it's our first year and we'll be doing it every year. So working with grad assistants and interns in terms of what I need them to do. And great.
Because my mother puts so much time and effort into each of her classes, my dad and I learned to pick up the slack very quickly because she does the same thing for us on a daily basis.
Enjoy everyone in my department. And, you know, at home, when I need you to cook dinner because I can't really break because I'm
like
working.
Like a little pancake fest yesterday.
So it was, you know, nice that I could, you know, count on you to pick up there when I need it.
Watching my mother find happiness in the workplace is something that I can honestly say is one of the greatest things to happen to our family. I love watching her thrive in an environment that she loves so much. It makes me so incredibly proud of her that she continued to keep at it when the odds were looking against her.
In this next podcast, our interview talks with the woman and how she tested the boundaries set by her parents as a young child.
Relationship with my parents was good. I believe my relationship with my father was a lot more challenging than my relationship with my mother. And I think that's because he was more of a disciplinarian. And my mom was more like a friend. So in many cases, if there was a issue, you know, if it was something that I would possibly think I would be disciplined for, I would run to my mother first, sort of to get the protection from my father's discipline. But it was overall a pretty good relationship. You never talk back. When I was young, what was considered disrespectful with my father or any adult in the case was talking back. You would never talk back. Definitely not one thing that was tolerated. That was something crazy to do, considering the backlash you would get. Now, I think my mother may be a little bit different because she really never disciplined me. And so our relationship was more of a negotiation. But, you know, with my father, it was whatever he said, it went, and there was no questions asked. I actually wouldn't say I was, quote unquote, closer to either one of my parents because they were my parents. You know, if I wanted that nurturing touch, I would run to my mother. And when it came to maybe advice, and it really depends on what that advice was, I would run to my father. But I think I had an equally close relationship with both of my parents. I think I've crossed a lot of boundaries with my parents, especially as an adolescent. And that's because in most cases, I did what I wanted to do and suffered the consequences later. There were many cases where I violated my curfew. And then, you know, I would come in and, you know, it would be a punishment or it would be a yelling match. But that was one of the boundaries that was set that tend to, in order to be cool, violate.
What happened when you came home late?
So I think first couple of times, punishment, yelling, it got to a point where my parents just decided, you know, I don't want to say to give up, but it was more or less just a simple conversation about why it's important to either call or why it's important to come in when you're supposed to come in. And that one-on-one conversation, it gave me insight, and it wasn't just, well, do what I say and do what I do, but this is why. And then it was at that point that I understood, oh, okay, so maybe I should call, or okay, maybe I, you know, should go in. And it had nothing to do with just being who I wanted to be and doing what I wanted to do. I kind of understood the reason behind why that boundary was set.
What do you think were the biggest expectations that your parents had for you?
I think the biggest expectations was to be respectful, was to be a young lady that can be trusted. You know, when it came to school, to my education, it was always to do the best that I possibly could to prepare and to succeed. As a young lady, it was to present myself as a young lady and nothing less than that. And as a daughter, it was just be myself, but also to respect my parents.
What were the expectations relating to your education?
So my expectations relating to my education was to always get a better grade than the last grade that I got. I did my best to always be on an honor roll, always be the top person, the top performer. I rarely would I even accept a C for myself, and anything less was, you know, I would cry. You know, I would feel my own pain. So it was just to be better, just always to better myself, and to do well, to be successful.
Talk to me about the boundaries as a young adult that you had trouble not crossing.
So as a child, one of the, one of the boundaries, one of the rules was to behave in school. And for some odd reason, I had an issue with behaving in school. And so I think, almost weekly, I would be disciplined because I did not know how to behave in school. We used to get progress reports, weekly progress reports, and you would get a check, which means it was satisfactory. You would get a check slash, which would be needs improvement, or you would get a zero, which means unsatisfactory. And with that zero, you usually get a note that says why it's a zero. And mine will always be in behavior. You know, homework assignments will always rise. My test grades, you know, being, you know, they were always good, but my behavior always ended up in a zero by the end of the week. No matter how hard I tried not to get a zero, I just did something, flip of the lip, flip of the mouth, just wrong. And I would say that, ended up not to my benefit.
Can you tell me a story about a boundary that you crossed, or, you know, that you've done something that was not so smart?
My aunt Lisa, she was coming home from work one day, and we were on the second level. She stayed on the second level. It was a three-story house. And I'm not even sure what even made my cousin and I do this. But so my cousin Patricia is the oldest, and there's my cousin Nikki. And so my cousin and I decided, or one of my cousins decided just she wanted to hang out the window. So my cousin and I held her out the window. And for some odd reason, we held her a little bit too long. We couldn't pull her up. So we just stood there holding her by her legs, hanging out the window until my aunt came home. And she said, "Hi, Mom." And my Aunt Lisa looked up. And I think she became a track star because she came up those steps so fast to pull her child in. And so I don't think my father, because that was his sister, my Aunt Lisa, I don't think my father ever knew about that story.
You know, you're telling me all these crazy stories about how you acted when you were younger. have you learned from your mistakes?
Yes, I feel like that I did learn from my mistakes. And any mistake that I made, whether as a child or as an adult, I think has made me a better person. I understand that I am going to make mistakes, even, you know, as an adult. I know that I'm going to continue to make mistakes because I'm not perfect. And sometimes mistakes are how you learn. And so when you make them, you understand there's either a consequence or a benefit to the decisions you make. And if it's a mistake, you reap what you sow and you move on from it. But the teaching in this is not to do it again. And so I think for every time I do make a mistake, I think it does make me a better person because I know that in the event that opportunity rolls around again, I know what decision to make the next time.
For the final podcast, our interviewee wants to see how friends deal with some of their physical boundaries in sports. The interviewee asks questions on how these boundaries limited their sports career and what they did to make sure they did not go over and hurt themselves.
So this is my friend Tian here, and we're going to be talking about physical boundaries. So Tian, what are some physical boundaries for yourself?
Well, physical body boundaries is like you can't overdo it, because when you start to overdo it when you're working out, you'll end up being sore or something like that.
Mm. So how have any of these boundaries affected your life?
Boundaries affected my life because certain things that with these boundaries you can't do, because if you try to go over, then you'll end up hurting yourself more than you'll help yourself.
Have you ever hurt yourself before?
Not really, because I've always known what my boundaries are.
Okay. Do you have any boundaries when you play sports?
Depending on the sport, if it's football, it's to make sure that all contact stays below your head so you don't end up with a concussion and end up in the hospital.
Have you ever had a concussion before in your life?
No, but I got close to getting one after a brutal hit.
How have some of these boundaries affected your sports life?
They've taken away from bigger plays that you could have had to try to impress scouts, college scouts, and stuff like that. Certain boundaries, they prohibit you from doing certain things. Certain people take it to another step. Yeah, they get the bigger plays, but they're risking their health just for a four-year scholarship that might not even get you further than that.
So would you say that taking those riskier plays are better, or are they not? They're not worth it?
In my opinion, they're not worth it because you're taking a chance. Yeah, you're going to make the big play that's going to impress everybody, impress all the scouts, impress all the girls. But if you miss that play, you could end up with physical injuries that could scar you for life. Like one person I know had ripped his knee so bad that he can't play sports ever again. And he can barely walk.
Tian also mentioned that one of his friends, Richard, had a heart problem.
Just my heart, it will, like, sometimes it overworks itself, so, like, my heart could, like, stop any minute. In, like, further years, if I keep on going and overworking myself, and, like, it hurts from, like, time to time on, like, some bumps. Like, it doesn't hurt, like, every time. Like, it hurts yearly, you can say. And that, I'm not sure what the symptom is or, like, what it really is, but, like, I know it's just, like, a couple blood clots and stuff, and I have to get surgery soon for it, so, yeah.
Have you ever done any sports in the past that have, like, affected your heart at all?
Well, I did play football, like, in my previous school, my middle school, and I did take a tumble on concrete and hit my head against the concrete and probably had a little bit of blood in my skull, but I'm not really sure if that really did because it didn't hurt at that time. But yeah, I did feel a slight pain in my chest and slight non-breathing, you can say. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
How do you think your heart will affect you when dealing with sports in the future?
Well, like, I do track now, and, like, I can't really run the distances I used to run before, and, like, my heart will kick in and be a pain, like, when I'm, like, halfway or just, like, almost at the finish, you can say.
Do you, like, try to push yourself past your heart knowing the consequences?
Yeah, actually. I already know that if I don't do what I have to do, like, I can just pass from my heart going out. But I still go above and beyond. And even though it hurts, I still just go for it. Because what's this, like, I wouldn't say that, you just gotta do what you gotta do, basically.
So you think if you didn't have this heart problem, you would succeed and achieve better things in sports?
Yeah, actually. Like, if I can actually do more sports and, like, actually stay up to task with a lot of things, you can say.
Have you ever tried to overcome some of your physical boundaries?
Probably once in a while. Pushing myself when you're in the workout room.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to get bigger, trying to be big like an offensive lineman, but that doesn't end up helping you at all.
So, like, what are some steps you've taken to become big like an offensive lineman?
You try to get on like an offensive lineman diet, like eat more, build cardio and stuff like that, and it's really hard when you have a high metabolism, so the food just burns off faster. You're eating more, you're working out more, it doesn't seem like you're not getting that many results.
Have you ever tried, like, how long have you tried doing this?
Tried it for a full season. And at some points it just seemed like way too much because I didn't have the metabolism to do it. My metabolism just was too fast. It would just burn the food off immediately. And it looked like I wasn't doing anything.
Do you feel that you have a better sports career without those boundaries?
I probably would. Like, I would probably get noticed much more if I didn't have these boundaries. Like, if I didn't set the personal boundary of don't go below, don't try for knee shots, don't jump really if you're not needed to. Like, if you do this extra stuff, then you're more likely to get noticed. You're more likely to make those bigger plays. But at what risk? That could risk walking for the rest of your life. It could risk brain damage.
Would you pass on to your children to take more risk in sports, or would you just tell them to be careful and take it slow?
I'd tell them to take it slower because, yeah, sports is a small window in everybody's life, so I would say do your best at it, but I wouldn't say go full out every day, every time you play. Like, sometimes you have to learn when to pull back and when to go over your boundaries.
What would you do if your children had physical problems and they wanted to do sports? What would you tell them?
I would tell my children just to watch their boundaries. It's certain things that you were put on this earth that you can and can't do. And sports may be one of them, you know. But if you want to do it, I'm not going to stop you. I'm going to get you whatever you need to do the sport. I'm just going to tell you to watch your boundaries and don't push yourself, don't go over, and you'll end up something wrong.
What would you do if one of your children ever got hurt because they pushed their boundaries? How would you feel about that?
I would tell them to really just slow it down. There's certain things that you can't do, like I said before. Certain things that I can't do and certain things that Richard can't do that we just weren't built to do. And if you can't do these things, don't keep pushing yourself because that's how you end up with really bad, bad injuries.
I asked both Richard and another friend, Kia, how they would feel if their children had physical problems.
If your children had this heart problem, would you like stop them from doing sports, or would you tell them to watch their boundaries?
I would just say watch their boundaries, or just that if they needed what I really needed, I would try to get it for them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, so basically just watch their boundaries, and if I had the money, I would get them what they need.
Well, it's not so much what I would say, it's what I would do. I would do anything in my power to make sure that they could do anything to their greatest extent. They want to play sports. So play sports.
Knowing that they could get seriously injured, would you still allow them to run track?
Well, first I would take them to see their physician, let them clear it, and if not, I don't think so, if it would put my child in harm or any form of danger.
I came back to Tian to ask him his final thoughts on the topic.
Would you say that it would make a person stronger if they go out and do their full potential every single time, or a stronger person knows what their risks are?
A stronger person definitely knows what their risks are. Like, everybody should push themselves progressively, but not just go ridiculous. Because when you go ridiculous, that's when you end up hurting yourself or not yourself.